From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Screenwriter, director, and Vietnam veteran Oliver Stone made the movies Platoon and Born on the 4th of July. On today's Fresh Air, in the second part of our interview, Oliver Stone tells us how he became a filmmaker after the war, and we talk about his work on the film Scarface, Salvador, and Wall Street. Also, we meet two members of Les Negres Vertes, a band from France that mixes French song with Arabic pop and gypsy music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz continues his review of the Toscanini reissues and video recordings. And Maureen Corrigan tells us she loves books, but she's a jealous lover. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush told a Hispanic group today that he wants to sign a civil rights bill, but continues to oppose the measure now before the United States Senate. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports that the negotiations have been going on all day.
Representatives of the White House and Congress have been trying to work out an agreement on a civil rights bill for months now. Yesterday, the measure's supporters hoped to speed up the process by voting to limit debate on the bill. That led to late-night negotiations, but no deal. And talks all day today have so far yielded no language that both sides can agree on. At issue is the question of how job discrimination on the basis of race or sex can be proved. If statistics show that a workforce is disproportionately white or male, supporters of this bill want employers to have to justify their hiring practices, showing that they are necessary for business purposes. Opponents, including the president, claim that will be so hard to do that businesses will simply establish racial or sexual quotas rather than take the risk of being sued. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
The Speaker of Iran's parliament blasted the U.S. Congress today for a letter of support sent to Iranian rebels. The letter was sent by 162 American congressional representatives to a group called the People's Holy Warriors based in Iraq. The letter called the Tehran regime a medieval dictatorship and said decisiveness was required to confront it. Iran's parliamentary leader denounced the letter as foolish and ineffectual. The Bush administration, in a major policy change, says it's withdrawing its support for a Cambodian rebel group fighting to overthrow the government backed by Vietnam. Richard Gonzalez has more.
Policy change was announced in Paris by Secretary of State James Baker. Until now, the U.S. has supported a rebel coalition, which included the Khmer Rouge, a communist movement held responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Cambodians during its 4 years in power in the 70s. The rebel coalition has scored a string of military victories recently, and U.S. officials fear that the Khmer Rouge could be on the verge of returning to power. Baker said the U.S. is now willing to open a dialogue with the Hanoi-backed government to pressure it to hold free and fair elections. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the policy change does not mean the U.S. is ready to normalize relations with Hanoi. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Rebel negotiators in the Liberian peace talks said today that there can be no ceasefire in the country's 7-month civil war as long as President Samuel Doe remains in power. The peace talks are underway in the neighboring West African nation of Sierra Leone. Stock prices fell today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 18 points to close at 2,981.68. Declines led advances by 2-1 in active trading. Volume was 169 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For screenwriter and director Oliver Stone, listening to The Doors brings back memories of getting high in Vietnam. Stone just finished shooting a movie about the drugged-out 60s rock group and its leader, Jim Morrison. Stone made two films about Vietnam, Platoon, based on his tour of duty, and Born on the 4th of July, based on the autobiography of veteran Ron Kovic. Yesterday on Fresh Air, we talked with Stone about The Doors and about fighting in Vietnam. He said that 8 days after he returned from the war, he was busted for possessing about an ounce of marijuana while crossing the border from Mexico. He says his father bought his way out of a San Diego jail. Today, on part two of our conversation, we find out how Oliver Stone ended up making movies. And we talk about some of the other movies he's made. Stone co-wrote and directed Salvador, Wall Street, and Talk Radio. He wrote the screenplays for Scarface, Midnight Express, Conan the Barbarian, and Year of the Dragon. I asked him how long it took after he got back from Vietnam before he started making films.
I was at a loss, I suppose. I didn't know what to do with my life. And I think I wandered around for several months in New York. And casually, you know, I'd always been interested in writing and had written. I was writing before I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote something. I went there twice, you know, to Vietnam. I was there
right, once to teach English.
Yeah, to teach English. And I was in the Merchant Marine also in 65 and 6. So I'd had a stock of experiences. So I started writing a screenplay when I got back from the war. And it was about Vietnam, but it was in a wholly surreal vein. And in many ways, it became the basis for Platoon many years later in 76. The same characters, but it was a pretty psychedelic film. I enlisted under the GI Bill, a veterans bill, at NYU Film School, which was in the city, and it was convenient. It was sort of a subway school at that time. And I went to film classes the following year. And I really was lucky in that out of the blue, my first teacher turns out to be Marty Scorsese, who was really inspired and passionate about film. And he conveyed that to us as a class, which was great. And we struggled, and we made short films with 16-millimeter Bolexes. We'd go out, we'd shoot 5-minute films, 10-minute films, and 16-millimeter, and work our way up to... I did three short films, about 20 minutes at Vietnam, at NYU during those 3 years.
Did Scorsese encourage you?
Very much. He was very, as I said, he was a great teacher to have.
What was your first big break into the industry after studying at NYU with Scorsese?
Well, it wasn't Marty alone. I mean, there was a lot of other teachers, too.
Right.
But, I think the point of film school is that nobody could get a job after they graduated. It was a bit of a joke, you know. You always you were out there on your own. You know, why were you studying it? There was a lot of, we certainly had a lot of depression about that. You know, you'd be lucky to get a PA job, a production assistant job on any film, but you couldn't get them. It was a lot different then than it is now. I mean, now the emphasis is on the youth market, so they're looking for scripts and about young people, and you see a lot of the film students are going right into major directing jobs and stuff. It was really hard. I worked as a cab driver. I worked as a Xerox messenger. I worked in a temporary with temp jobs, typing pools. My first wife was supportive. She had a good job, and you know, I wrote scripts, two scripts a year, but nobody would read them. No agents, all that kind of stuff, and shuffling back and forth, hoping for a break. I think Robert Bolt really gave me my first break in 70, about 4 years later. In 75, the English screenwriter read one of my scripts, liked it, and brought me out to work with him on the same script. He improved it with me and gave me a lot of insight and got me an agent, my first agent in 75, about 4 years after I gotten out. And then I wrote Platoon in 76, but nobody wanted to make it, but they liked it enough that somebody at Columbia sent me over to England to work on this small book they'd bought called Midnight Express with a young director called Alan Parker, and the picture became a huge hit internationally. It was cost very little money, about $3 million. I think it made more than $100 million. It was a huge international success. And I got the Academy Award, and that opened up the door.
Did that open up the door enough for you to start directing?
Yeah, I got a chance to direct. They wouldn't let me direct the Platoon, actually, I worked on Born on the 4th of July, too. I wrote that following the Midnight Express thing with Al Pacino, just supposed to star in it. But they wouldn't let me direct that. They would let me direct something a little in the more commercial vein. It was a horror film called
The Hand.
The Hand.
Yeah.
And it was not successful, but I learned a lot. I got to work with Michael Caine, who was taught me a lot of tricks.
Name one.
And
what's one of the tricks?
How to be cool.
Yeah, well, he's the right guy for that job.
He was a funny man.
Tell me about him showing you how to be cool. I mean, like...
Oh, I don't know. I was a pretty fiery director. You know, I wanted him to make a best effort on everything. I wanted to kill himself, you know, for the movie. And Michael had done like 30 or 50 movies, I don't know. So to him, this was like, you know, a job. You know, you go in, you check in, you do it, and you leave. And I don't know, one day I said to him at the bar, I said, look, Michael, I'm not seeing this expression on your face. I'm sorry. I just, not said. He said, you will, dear boy. In the rushes, you'll see them.
Did you?
Oh, I forgot. I mean, it was a hard film to make, actually, because it was a lot of special effects. And I put myself in a no-win situation. Never make a picture about a monster that's about a foot across, and it's too small a monster to make work, because you got to put very elaborate machinery inside the hand. You know, it's better to get a gorilla or a shark or something large.
I'll remember
and,
that.
It's very complex machinery. We had about 40 different hands, you know, that would do different things. And I worked like a dog on the film, and they kept on wanting more horror. And we never could settle that. It was always a psychological story, and I screwed it up. You know, I should have really stuck to my guns. And I learned a lesson, which was stick to your guns on a movie. Do what your first instinct. You know, if it was a psychological horror movie, that's what it should have been. And it was not really a shock movie, but it became a movie that became more known for a hand than about a mental state of Michael Caine, you see. And the film died, and I was non grata for a while, I guess, you know. Like, forget it, you know. I went back to writing. I wrote Scarface, which was a long haul, too. I wrote Conan the Barbarian, Scarface, and You're the Dragon.
You wrote Scarface, I think, right after you'd given up drugs yourself.
Yes, yeah.
So it must have been interesting to get so deep into the cocaine trade in the movie just as you'd stopped.
Well, I've always believed in using your own experience, you know. So if Vietnam, I wanted to use Vietnam, not let it use me. And, you know, having done a fair amount of cocaine, I never overdid it. I kind of felt like, gee, why don't I use my knowledge, you know, and put it into the Scarface character instead of letting the drug whip you, you know. And it does, you know. Cocaine is the worst. It's a real enslaving kind of drug. It wrecks your brain cells. I put everything I knew into a film. I did a lot of research in South America.
And, did you really? You went
Miami,
to Miami,
yeah, and Caribbean. The Caribbean is
was this
was
for
crazy.
The movie, or had you done this before?
Partly before and partly for the movie, but I remember hanging out in the Caribbean with some of these crazy guys. I mean, they're pretty wild, South Americans.
Plenty of colorful dialogue you wrote for Scarface. Do you have any favorite lines from it, or lines that still get quoted to you?
Oh, yeah. To so many. I mean, that was a cult hit, you know.
Yeah.
Every dog has his day. Every day above ground is a good day.
Did you write Don't Get High on Your Own Supply?
Yeah.
Was that your line?
Yeah. There's a lot. You remember that? I wasn't prepared for this, but there are a lot of lines.
I remember when I interviewed Robert Loggia, he did the Haza line.
That was great. Don't be a Haza.
Yeah. In the days when you were trying to shop Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, what were the official reasons you were given for why no one wanted to make a war
You know
movie?
What a Haza is, Frank? It's a pig that don't fly straight. That was it. God. That was a great scene when he was begging for his life. You know, you wouldn't. Don't shoot me, don't shoot me, you know. You wouldn't kill a cop, whoever said you were one. What'd you say?
In the days when you were trying to shop Born on the 4th of July and Platoon and no one wanted to make a Vietnam War movie, what were the official reasons that they'd give you?
Oh, they never give you official reason, yeah. You never know why they...
Right, but they give you reasons, whether they're the real reasons.
Too downbeat.
Uh-huh.
Depressing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Bourne was a disgusting situation because we went through a year of work. I mean, Pacino was great in that picture. I mean, I saw the rehearsals. You know, we worked on it a lot. And,
oh, you actually got that
far? Yeah, I rehearsed the whole movie. We were 3 days from shooting. We had the whole thing cast.
You're kidding.
I was the writer, and Dan Petrie was directing it. And it was all set up. The locations, it was, it was a very little amount of money. I mean, it was $6 million in 1978 terms. We just couldn't get the money wasn't there at the day one of the shoot, and the whole thing folded, and it was depressing beyond words. Kovic went crazy, and I did too, and it was just I gave up on the concept of ever really getting meaningful pictures made in the inside that system.
Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone is my guest. His movies include Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, and Salvador. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone is my guest. I think the movie Salvador was a breakthrough film for you in a way, because you wrote and directed it. It was a critical success, if not a big commercial hit. One of the things that really struck me in Salvador was the scenes of carnage. I haven't seen it in several years, but I just remember scenes of them driving along the road or walking and coming across just piles of bodies along the road, people who had disappeared. I just remember how effectively you had handled that, and I was wondering if you could describe what you did.
I think with Salvador, which we did in 1985 with Richard Boyle, I just had it with that whole development process. You know, I decided that I was going to go the independent route completely, and I don't care what was going to happen. I was going to make a film. I told my wife, Elizabeth, I'm mortgaging the house. I'm going to borrow every dime I can get. I'm going to produce and make this film myself. You know, screw the system, basically. And with that kind of determination, I set out to go to Salvador, and we tried to make a deal with the Salvadoran military to give us their helicopters by saying that the death squads were really communists. And, you know, then we were going to shoot the other half of the movie in Mexico. We were going to show that the death squads were really government soldiers, you know, funded by the U.S. military. So we were playing like a real shell game with these guys. But we came close until our advisor, Cienfuegos, got shot one day on the tennis court. The FMLN blew his brains out and draped a flag over him. I'm in New York, and it's on the front page of the New York Times. You know, so there goes our project. But at the same time, we ran into a British company, Hemdale, and John Daly loved the thing, and he put up the dough right away. Not much, but he put up enough to get it made. And he just thought it was an anarchic kind of comedy, that it could be, two wild men. He always wanted to emphasize the comedy aspect, which I agree with him. I mean, these guys, Boyle is a funny guy, and we wanted to take an irreverent approach to the war. We didn't want to get too solemn, you know, because it is a solemn issue. But it grew out of that, and what was the question?
About the carnage.
Oh, the carnage? Well, I mean, it was a shock to me. I went down there and traveled around Central America. I could see the whole thing building again, the same number as Vietnam. The same guys, the same faces, uniforms, young kids, 19, they look like me, walking around the streets of Tegucigalpa in Honduras, and, you know, saying, you know, we're fighting communism here, you know, we're fighting this ideological enemy. And I'd ask them, do you remember Vietnam? And the guys wouldn't remember. It was driving me crazy, because, you know, one of the functions of film is supposedly to, you know, relate to social history of the United States as we go. You know, that's what they did in the 30s and the 40s. To some degree, you're supposed to do that. But they didn't have any grip on Vietnam. They didn't understand it. And we were repeating the same cycle was going on. It was really depressing to me. And it sort of helped motivate me to get these films done faster. I did Salvador and Platoon back to back, you know, right there in 1985 and 6. And I think it did some good, because I think that there was a definite, I don't want to sound too grandiose, but I thought there was a definite shift in the country in 85-6. I think Reagan, to some degree, lost his mandate. And it had a lot to do with Ollie North, because that hit in 86, right, late 86. Just when, right before Platoon came out, Ollie North broke. And 86 was the crux of the year that Reagan kind of lost it. He couldn't have that. He was building this energy to win. It was no question he was going to invade Nicaragua. No question at all.
I guess, I'm curious, too, in how you, like, shot the scenes of the bodies. Did you want to talk about that?
Oh, the bodies, Yeah. You shoot bodies. How do you... I got Gordon Smith, who's, like, one of the best makeup guys in the world. He studies cadavers in hospitals.
Oh, really?
He digs it, you know? He goes to morgues late at night. He's like Dr. Death. So we brought him down from Canada, and he had a field day, you know, making up corpses. You get extras at 5 in the morning, you get them out there, and you start making them up, and you make them look white and ashen and dead, and then you hope they don't move when you're shooting them. What else you want to know?
You must have some crazy outtakes from that.
Oh yeah, they're always moving. When you get 600 bodies lying in a canyon, there's always some guy stands up right in the middle of it, you know. He's got to take a pee or something.
I imagine in your early films that you worked a lot off of anger and frustration. You know, anger and frustration coming both from your days in Vietnam and also from your frustration of wanting to make movies and having to work within the system and being frustrated from that. Was there a point in your career where the energy you were working off have shifted from anger and frustration to something else? I might be completely off track here, so...
Yeah, I think you're pretty close. I think that after Platoon got so much international recognition that it kind of like, okay, let's go. Let's keep going, though. But there is that original promise that was made, which is to do films a certain way and of a certain style, and they would have integrity. But now, you know, it's not so much fighting to get it made. It's like, okay, it's a given. We're going to make the picture. So you lose a lot less energy and time, you know, struggling to get it made. Now it's more like, I got a system down. I got a program. I mean, I can do one complicated picture every year because I have a great crew with producer Alex Ho and Clayton Townsend, great cameraman, great production designer, and editors, you know, so that everybody's kind of like in sync, you know. And the hard thing, of course, is keeping that crew together because people in our field are very creative and neurotic and they move on, they go to other films and other jobs. But I'm trying to keep a team together, you know, but it makes it easier.
Are the struggles different now, or the struggles within the system to cast the person you want to cast or to keep the ending that you want to keep?
No, I don't have nobody changes the script because I'm accepted as a writer director of the thing or co-writer. So I do the script as I see it. Casting, yeah, there's always a bit of a struggle, you know, because you want to fit something in for a certain price. I think the salaries paid to movie actors are insane, you know. It's wrecking a lot of the fun of the business. I mean, people like Cruise, if they believe in something, we worked on Born for Nothing for a year, you know, so we got the picture made at a price of $18 million. The Doors was considerably more expensive, but not because of actors' salaries. They were all relatively young actors, and not that nobody was a big star. It was more a question of just of shooting in Los Angeles, which was complicated because it's an expensive town. We had a lot of crowd scenes, huge amount of concerts we had to do. And music, a musical per se, is more expensive. But those are the struggles. It's not like, you know, I mean, right now I think I can do pretty much any subject as long as it's not boring. I don't want to make it boring. Yeah. I don't want to, any social issue is good to make as long as, you know, but you can't do a film on the environment just because it's about the environment, you know. As much as we feel about it, you got to find a way to tell that story.
What kind of scripts do you have that haven't been made yet that you want to get made?
Oh, I can't tell you that.
Okay, right. And the reason why you couldn't tell me is that the fear that somebody else would say, hey, that's a great idea, I'll write that myself.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's what happens to me. After Platoon came out, I remember I gave an interview and somebody said, what do you want to do? What kind of, you ever do anyone do anything completely different? I said, yeah, I'd love to do a dog story. And there hadn't been any dog stories made right around that period of time. And all of a sudden, if you notice, from 86 to 89, there was like 9 dog stories that got made.
So there were? I didn't even notice.
Yeah, big ones too. And I I said, now I'm going to shut my mouth. So now I can't make a dog story.
Would you ever do a war film again, or do you feel that you've made your statement about Vietnam and about war?
No, I'd like to do another Vietnam piece, but it's not so directly about the American soldiers in Vietnam. It's more of a overview from another perspective, and I'd like to make that picture in the next 2 to 3 years. I'd like to really ultimately do this trilogy on Vietnam, make it a trilogy.
So what would the angle be on? Oh, you probably want to talk
about it. I can't tell, it's not over yet. No, war is with us, and it will be there. I mean, I have no illusions about the Cold War being over. I think that we have a war party in the United States, and it's, you know, dedicated to spending a certain amount of money per year on a mission. Mr. Bush calls it now the war on drugs. It's the latest thing, you know.
Let me ask you about the film Wall Street. Your father was or is a stockbroker.
Was
a stockbroker. Yes. Where would he have fit into that movie, if at all?
Dad would probably be a combination of Marty Sheen and Hal Holbrook. You know, he was the older broker, doing things a bit the old-fashioned way. And also a lot of the scenes between Marty and Charlie were kind of like scenes I based on my own relationship with Dad.
Did he want you to go into the business ever?
Oh, when I was young, yeah, before college. Yeah, he thought it would be a good way to make a living, you know. But it was never, I never was any good at that. My mathematics were pretty dreadful. I did terribly in economics, that's right. Freshman in college, I got a D or a C in economics. I just couldn't understand economics. It's very dismal.
But
he was good at it.
But I guess all that background helped you for the movie.
The mood of the movie, yeah. I found it very confusing, but I tried to clarify. I think I did a pretty good job of... Stanley Weiser, of course, helped me. He was my co-writer, but I think we clarified the a very difficult situation. We tried to make it clear, you know, the actual mechanics of what goes on and how buyouts are made and how you can make money off stock. But Dad wouldn't recognize the new Wall Street. They're moving huge amounts of volume. It's just jumped. I mean, it's really a computerized business now. In the old days, he was a customer's man. You know, you dealt with an individual group of clients. You took care of them over time. It was a relationship, like a banker with a small town or something like that. And he was also an economist. He wrote wonderful letters about economics for a monthly investment letter, which was very well respected in the 50s, 60s internationally. He considered himself really more of a writer than a really great businessman. But he would not recognize that Wall Street. The whole concept of making that money would elude him.
Were you a movie-obsessed kid?
Yeah, I loved the movies.
What movies made the biggest impression on you?
Oh, I went to them, all of them, the good ones. Dad would take me, Mom would take me. The Kubrick pictures when I was a kid. Huge impression. Paths of Glory, Strangelove. Quality films, you know, like David Lean's pictures, Lawrence of Arabia. I remember being knocked out by Fellini's La Dolce Vita in 59 or something like that, 8.5. Then the new wave just blew me away. Godard, The Breathless, I couldn't believe. I thought that was just the new thing, you know, and then Truffaut's pictures and Chabrol. So the French took over, and then René Alain René. But I never thought I could go into movies. You know, it was something so exotic that it was not something you did for a living. It was something you just enjoyed.
You knew nobody who did something like that for a living, right?
Not really, no. We had no. My family was very New York-oriented, really didn't know L.A.
Thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Oliver Stone. His movies include Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, and Talk Radio. He's completing a film on The Doors that's scheduled to come out in March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Frank Friel. He was the chief investigator for the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force that broke the city's organized crime family and put mob boss Nicky Scarfo in prison. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The mix of cultures in Paris has found its way into the music of Les Négresses Vertes, a French band that blends French song, Algerian rye, gypsy guitar, and rock and roll. Coming up, we meet the band's guitarist an accordionist. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, NBC TV broadcast some classic Toscanini concerts. Now they're being released on video for the first time. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of the new videos, as well as some reissues of Toscanini recordings. And commentator Maureen Corrigan gets possessive about her favorite books. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Lawmakers and Bush administration officials working to cut the federal budget deficit met for 1 hour and a half today with President Bush. The meeting came just hours after House Republican members repudiated the president on the issue of taxes. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president was sent a strong message from members of his own party in the House today. They voted in a closed caucus to oppose new taxes and all tax rate increases to reduce the deficit. Democratic House Speaker Thomas Foley called it an unhelpful resolution. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell reiterated his party is not going to stand alone in favor of higher taxes.
It will be necessary, of course, for any agreement to pass the Congress. And as we've stated on many occasions, that will require a majority of votes of both parties in both houses, and that requirement was acknowledged today.
Some Republicans tried to downplay the significance of their vote. All it says is Republicans oppose taxes, said one GOP negotiator, adding, "We've always opposed taxes." This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Officials from rebel groups in Cambodia have criticized a U.S. decision to open talks with Vietnam. Secretary of State James Baker reversed 15 years of American policy, saying in Paris today that the U.S. will talk to Vietnam as a step towards settling the Cambodian civil war. Roger Morier reports from Paris.
Sun Sen is the man who leads the Cambodian government in exile, which is made up of the Khmer Rouge, Prince Sihanouk supporters, and his own. It is this coalition which is battling the regime in Phnom Penh. It is this coalition which Secretary Baker said today the United States would no longer support. In Paris, Sun Sen says the American decision is a mistake, adding that it could damage the prospects for peace. It's playing into the hands of Hanoi and Phnom Penh, he says, adding that he is going to call for a meeting of his coalition partners in the next few weeks to decide what to do next. In Bangkok as well today, an official representing Prince Sihanouk said the U.S. decision means friends of the U.S. will be hurt. The Khmer Rouge, the third party in the coalition, has so far been silent on the Baker announcement. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Morier in Paris.
In the U.S., new housing construction fell over 2% last month to its lowest level since 1982. At the same time, though, applications for new housing permits jumped almost 4% for the first increase since January. The Commerce Department also said construction of new single-family homes edged down 0.1% in June. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 18 points to close at 2,981.68 on volume of some 167 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, a visit with a band from France. Last week, classical music critic Lord Schwartz enthusiastically reviewed part of RCA Victor's new Toscanini collection. Their extensive series of audio and video discs and tapes of the maestro's work is being released over the next 4 years. Lloyd has a review of the latest batch.
Between 1948 and 1952, in the earliest days of TV, NBC telecast 10 Toscanini concerts. These are now commercially available here for the first time. The original kinescopes have been beautifully restored. Of course, you can hear Toscanini's clarity and concentration, his dignity and lack of ego on all his recordings, but watching him is even more revealing and moving. There's not a wasted or theatrical or self-dramatizing gesture. The intensity is all in his face and in his baton. You can also see the seating arrangement of his orchestra is designed for instrumental definition rather than homogenized blend. Cellos and basses behind the first violins on the conductor's left, second violins, harps, and percussion over on his right. The videos include a noble, unrhetorical Brahms First Symphony, a Beethoven Ninth with a different set of soloists from the studio recording, and some Wagner, Debussy, and Rossini, also among Toscanini's favorite composers. The Toscanini CDs and cassettes are also proceeding right on schedule, and the latest batch has an impressive variety. There's a strong, unsentimental New World Symphony, an irresistibly flowing Moldau, an exuberant Hari Janos suite, and a sonically spectacular Respighi album, among the rare Toscanini recordings that actually started out in brilliant sound. Toscanini's marvelously witty and moving performance of Strauss's Don Quixote shows off the extraordinary solo caliber of the NBC players, especially that overlooked master cellist Frank Miller, who plays the tragic comic title role. Toscanini insisted that lighter music had to be played at least as well as great masterpieces. "You must put your blood," he told the orchestra. Toscanini's bonbons range from Bach's sublime air from his third suite to Paganini's Moto Perpetuo, a tour de force for the string section. "I've always regarded Toscanini's Dance of the Hours from Ponchielli's La Gioconda as one of the most dazzling orchestral performances ever recorded, and now it sounds better than ever. No other version I've heard has ever matched the NBC Orchestra's phenomenal precision, sparkle, and sweep." You'll probably be hearing more about Toscanini from me again when RCA releases the very first recordings Toscanini made in the early 20s with the La Scala Orchestra, as well as his famous performances with the New York Philharmonic in the 30s, which some people regard as his greatest recordings of all, and his beautiful recordings with the Philadelphia Orchestra, which for complicated reasons Toscanini himself refused to release. 71 selections will be issued in all, plus the 10 TV concerts on Laserdisc or videocassette. The series of expressive photos of Toscanini by Robert Hupka on the album covers is itself worth the price of admission. Keep your eye out, too, for the numerous live Toscanini performances and fascinating rehearsals on other labels, including a wonderful historical document on Standing Room Only, Toscanini's return to the rebuilt La Scala just after World War II. This is a good time for Toscanini,
and for all of us.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Toscanini collection on RCA Victor. This is Fresh Air. Les Negres Vertes is a band from France. The music is a mix of French song, Algerian rye, and gypsy music. The members of the band are from French, Algerian, Italian, and Spanish backgrounds. As one member of the band once put it, they play the music of a wonderful mongrel culture. Several years ago in a dance hall, someone less appreciative of their racial mix threatened to rearrange their faces and called them Les Negres Vertes, which translates to the green-black women. The band decided to subvert this racist comment and use it as their name. Les Negres Vertes has a record that was recently released in the States, and the band just completed an American tour. My guests are Stéphane Melino, who plays guitar and sometimes sings lead, and Mathieu Canavez, who plays accordion and guitar. Melino was born in Algeria, Canavez in France.
For us, we consider that like a modern French song, so influenced by all the ethnies living in France now. I mean, like us, coming from North Africa or in the Latin countries. The difference with old French song is that we are born in the 60s, and rock and roll, we grew up in rock and roll, so it's very important for us. We are playing our songs with a rock and roll energy, you know, and that's it.
So tell me about the music that you were both exposed to when you were young.
Oh, music, Spanish music, gypsy music, North African music too, and even French music, Edith Piaf, or every style of music, you know. But my family influenced me a lot in music.
It's the same for me. I grew up with jazz records and French song records like Gainsbourg or Piaf. It's very important. With the Beatles too. A lot of different things.
You know, on your record, there's absolutely no English translation, not of the lyrics, not even of the instruments that everybody in the band plays. Was that your decision to keep it all strictly French?
Yeah, a little bit, to keep the French version of the record. It was important for the first one to show where we're from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know, perhaps one day we will write a song in English. We can write we write what we feel. So one day after all this trouble.
We made our first song in English for a compilation on AIDS. It will be released, I think, in 6 months. We made a cover of Cole Porter, I Love Paris. And Elno is singing in English. It's the first time.
That's great.
It's not bad.
It's good, yeah.
Il va sa vache qui pisse, qu'on n'a pas déconné les vieux, il est là sous la pluie, il ne sait où aller, il est là comme un con, il est plutôt paumé, c'est son chien qui le guide, il va de pisse en pisse, il va de crotte en crotte, son destin est bien triste, c'est une vie de chien. Il boit pour oublier qu'il vit, il dort pour oublier qu'il voit.
You know, I know just a little bit of French, so when I listen to one of your songs, I don't really know what the lyrics are. And in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, I hope this isn't something like, wives should always be lovers too, run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. You know, you don't really know what you're listening to when you don't understand the lyrics.
Yeah, you can feel things.
Right, that's true.
But if you want to deeply understand what we are talking about, you need a translation. And we are using a lot of slang, double sound sentence, you know, a lot of humor, words game, and like in the French style, you know, using a lot of black humor, satiric sentence, like Zobi Lamouche, you know, the French Batman.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a strange guy. He's got a satiric view on life.
Yes.
Now, Matthew, you used to play in a circus?
Yeah, I was not to play. I was working in a circus.
What were you doing?
Everything, you know, circus life. You need to drive the trucks, to build the tent, to act. You need to do gymnastics, to ride horses. You need to know how to take care of the animals. It's a full job.
Is there any connection between the circus and the band?
Sure. About a lot of points, you know, traveling, living in community, on the road, I mean, to get a family life on the road.
The feeling is the same.
The feeling, yes, to play in front of people, to play like we are playing, to give to the crowd a living show, you know. We are making living music.
Stefan, how did you meet Matthew? And maybe you could tell us a little bit of the story of how the band formed.
I met Matthew and the rest of the band. Not Matthew and the guy from Paris, I met them in Paris. In the mid-80s, you know, there was a movement in Paris around the punks band and painters and video shooters, you know. And we all met at this time in Paris.
In 82, 83.
82, 83, yes. It was really a good movement. A lot of bands come from this movement. Les Negres Vertes, Mano Negra, Satellite, a lot of bands which are known now. And we met at this time and we decided to work together. The opportunity, if we have the opportunity to work together.
Stefan, when your family moved to France when you were around 2 years old, how much Algerian music did you hear after that?
Oh, a lot of Algerian music, because you know, not only Algerian music in the way of Arabian, you know, rhythm and Arabian notes and Arabian melodies, but also in Algeria there was a lot of French and Italian and Spanish were living there. They were Algerian because they were living there since 4 or 5 generation, and they bring with them their culture, and it was a mix with the French and the Algerian culture, and I come from that. It's a very mixed culture. And now what we can say is the reggae music, it becomes very important in France. And it's very near from our sensibility, and we feel it very strong and we love it.
When you were growing up and listening to rock and roll, both of you, was it mostly American rock and roll or French rock and roll that you were listening
French
to?
French rock and roll is not existing. You cannot say French rock and roll. It's a wrong sentence.
American and English rock and roll.
Yeah, American and English rock and roll.
Why was there no French rock and roll?
Because rock and roll is not French, you know.
There was French rock and roll.
There was, but it was not. The problem is they were every time trying to copy British and American rock and roll. It's the thing we don't want to do, you know, because we prefer to work on our culture, to use to play our songs with a rock and roll energy, but not to use rock and roll music anymore.
So you grew up listening to rock and roll with English lyrics.
Yeah.
What effect did it have on you to, I don't know how much English you spoke when you were young.
Nothing.
No. So what effect did it have to love this music but not understand the lyrics?
It was very strong. You know, the feeling we had was very strong because when you are listening to the Beatles or to the Stones for the first time, we were captured by that. Caught. I don't know the real world, but it was very strong, you know, even if we were not understanding it. And it's the same now when we are singing in French in front of a Japanese or a British or an American crowd. People are not understanding deeply what we are talking about, but they can feel something very strong. They can feel the ambience of each song. They can...
The emotion.
The emotion of the show in his totality.
When you got older and started to understand English and went back to some of the records by the Beatles or the Stones that you grew up on, did you have a different reaction being able to understand the lyrics?
Yeah, because you're discovering things, you know, and what you feel when you were young, what you felt when you were young, you discover that the lyrics were in the same sense, you know, so it's very nice. The deception was coming from Led Zeppelin a little bit.
What do you mean?
Because the music is so strong, you know. When you are not understanding what they're talking about, you think it's great, and after you're understanding the lyrics, it's a little bit cheap. We were surprised by the lyrics of Plant.
Things like the way you squeeze my lemon.
It was not strong as the music was, I think.
Well, I wish you a very good trip back to Paris.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, all right. See you next year.
Guitarist Stéphane Melinot and accordionist and guitarist Mathieu Canavez from the band Les Négresses Vertes. Their new album is on Sire Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today, news of an apparent shift in U.S. policy on Cambodia. The United States, up to this point, has supported a role for the Khmer Rouge in the coalition trying to oust the Vietnamese-backed government in Phnom Penh. Now it seems the U.S. will talk to that government as it becomes a bit edgy over the Khmer Rouge's evident successes and very prominent role in the rebel movement. Also today, news of Iraqi threats against neighboring Kuwait, the progress of the civil rights bill on Capitol Hill, and what happened to all the guard dogs from the Berlin Wall now that the wall is down?
Well, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some people don't like to share food. Some people don't like to share clothes. Critic Maureen Carrigan says what's really hard for her is to share her favorite books.
If you've ever had the miserable experience of seeing a loved one being held tightly by a stranger, you'll know how I felt last week. I was riding on the Washington Metro, seated across from two older women. They seemed pleasant enough until one rummaged in her bag and took out a volume of Stevie Smith's poems. Then they both began talking about how wistful and tragic her work is. My heart skipped a beat. I love Stevie Smith. She's irreverent about all the right things, death, sex, God, and literature. Her cunning, childlike voice created a whole new way to be naughty in literature. She always sounds to me like some playground anarchist. If Bart Simpson were a poet instead of a cartoon, he'd be Stevie Smith. But some misguided readers, like these two women, insist on seeing Stevie Smith as a fey waif. "Stop it," I wanted to shout. "You don't know her like I do. She's my kindred spirit, not yours." I know, it's foolish and probably elitist to feel so possessive about an author. And especially given the current censorship spree, it's more dangerous than ever to feel that there's only one correct interpretation of a work of art. But the experience of reading something you love can be so intense that sometimes it actually hurts to see someone else putting their paws all over your special book and reading it differently. Summertime is a really rough season on these kinds of bookish attachments. Books that I thought I had a monogamous relationship with turn out to be running around with other people all over town. Vivian Gornick's autobiography, Fierce Attachments, was snuggled in someone else's jeans pocket at the neighborhood softball game, and Charlotte Bronte's Villette was lying on someone else's blanket at the beach. I even saw M.F.K. Fisher's The Art of Eating out at a bar. Figures, she always liked a good time. Now, I don't have this delusion of exclusivity with every book I love. With David Copperfield, Beloved, and The Caine Mutiny, it was clear right from the start that I was going to have to share. And Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim is passed on from friend to friend like some kind of initiation test. If you laugh at it, you're okay. The act of reading is almost always private, just you and the book, alone together. Some books just weren't made for that one-on-one intensity. They need a community of readers and a variety of interpretations to make them come alive. But other books construct you, the reader, as a confidant. They flatter you into thinking that you're the person who really understands them, someone special. These kinds of books always make me think that I'm the only one, and I keep getting burned.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Breaking the Philadelphia Mob, a talk with Frank Friel, the former chief investigator and co-director of the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force. Also, Weird Al Yankovic tells us how he turns rock songs about sex into songs about food. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
It's 8 o'clock on 9.